Welcome to Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford. This week, it's a real variety pack of arts, beginning with a great new original musical, the Open Dream Ensemble premiere about Gordy, the little boy with big shoes to fill or not, is coming up this weekend, and we'll get a sneak peek from the Actors Studio. Then, there's new leadership and a grand opening at the Charlotte and Philippines Art Gallery at Wake Forest University. Director Paul Bright's a man with a vision, and it's all on paper. We'll get bookish with Bookmarks Festival Executive Director Ginger Hendricks, bring the warmth of the Caribbean to the Triad, and cool off at the Water Fountain with Delta Art Center's Rodney Holman. Peter Kiroff is here at the keyboard with the lowdown on the use of dynamics in music. And New River Blues Festival directors Rob Hound Dog Baskerville and Penny Queen Bees of Magny will join us live in Studio A. I'd say that's a pretty full show. Theater, art, literature, music theory, and singing the blues next on Triad Arts Up Close. Big Shoes is the story of a little boy named Gordy. Open Dream Ensemble presents this new original musical Saturday, September 1st at 2 o'clock in Thrust Theater on the University of North Carolina School of the Arts campus. The performance is free and open to the public. Open Dream Ensemble is a project of the Thomas S. Keenan Institute for the Arts and an outreach program of UNCSA. Big Shoes playwright and actor Michaela Morton, director Beth Bostick, actors Haiti Thompson, William von Reichbauer, and Open Dream general manager Rebecca Nussbaum stop by to dream. Beth chimed in first. Big Shoes. Tell me the story.
Big Shoes is the story of a boy named Gordy who has an older brother who is just all that and a bag of chips. And he wants to join the club that his brother's forming, which is an explorer's club. But in order to do that, he needs to prove himself by having a daring exploration. So he decides to climb the local mountain all by himself. And he takes his brother's shoes with him. And on his adventure, many magical and strange things happen.
Oh, what a lovely pair of shoes you brought on your feet. What lovely news that is for a robber like me. Who can slip on
Gordy discovers that having big shoes isn't really the answer or necessary. And he finds out that he needs to have his own shoes that fit.
Become part of a long, noble line of people whose personalities are mine.
That is a great story. I love the stories when you hear them and you think, that's a great idea. I must have seen that someplace. It must be an iconic story from ages old. Great. Hats off. That's wonderful. And the whole image of the shoes is perfect. How did you come to that idea?
It was almost fully formed when it popped out as an idea, but I was on a layover in Texas. I got a day shaved off of a vacation. I was really mad that I was going to have 4 days instead of five, and I called my mom, and I'm sitting on the floor and eating froyo. And I already knew at that point that I was going to be writing a children's play for the competition that Open Dream was having at the time, and she said, this could be a real blessing. Maybe you're going to land that plane, and you'll already have a full synopsis of your show.
Mama always knows.
She wasn't all the way there, but it was prophetic enough, because I was sitting on the floor, and I started thinking about this little boy who lived in a world that was just his size, where everything fit him. And so I was kind of typing this out on my computer, and it went something like, you know, his bed is just his size, and his room is just his size, and his bunny is just the same size as he is, which is great for cuddling, though not great for sharing the bed, which is also just his size. And that boy had also an older brother whose world was significantly larger than his own. If I had stuck with that concept, we would have gotten into some real metaphysical problems and also set design issues. that one was complicated, but it clarified down into this idea of the shoes. And I think maybe I had the title kind of right from the get-go. I like titles. I think that would be a pretty great job to have, just naming things.
See how my feet get bigger. See how your feet stay small. See how I can become what I need to be, and I can be whatever I want to be. I get what I want, and I am what I've got. See, little Gordy, I've got it all!
No! You haven't got anything. Just a bunch of old shoes.
Okay, so now that I know what the show's about, Haiti, I've seen you before, by golly. And so, six previous productions with Open Dream Ensembles.
Yeah.
I'm going back to the Dream Machine. Were you in that one?
Dream Machines, yes. I played Catherine Wright, the Wright brothers' sister.
What I was really taken with was not only the original music for that one as well, and the performance and the whole story, but the impact it had on the kids. They were mesmerized. It was a hallway full of kids, and you could just see them getting really quiet all of a sudden. What's it like when you're up there, you see that kind of engagement up on stage?
Like nothing else, really. You get you come off from doing something like that for kids, and they just look at you like you're a rock star, you know.
In terms of your craft, how does it make you better as an actor? Because in addition to acting and forging these relationships as an actor, you're teaching as well. And I guess a lot of folks don't know about that aspect of Open Dream Ensemble. It's much more than just a performance and you pack up and leave.
Absolutely. A lot of times we'll have residencies, 1 to 2 week residencies. I'm trying to make the connection actually with my craft in that it takes an incredible amount of focus to put a production like this on. I think that's one of the things that we bring into the classroom is the necessity for that type of focus to make something happen or to learn something in their case. So in a residency situation, we're going to move the desks back. Everyone gets on their feet. We're going to teach science, but through the focus that it takes to be an actor or be a dancer. For all those things to happen on stage, we have to listen to each other and know what's happening next. So that's where the integration kind of comes in, too. We might only be there a week, so, you know, I'm not going in there teaching you're going to be an actor at the end of this week.
Sure.
But the sort of essential skills that it takes to put on that amazing production that you kids just saw didn't just happen. You know, we really had to focus. And that's a big thing that we bring into the classroom.
Rebecca, music composed for Open Dream Ensemble is a really important part of that collaborative aspect of everything that I've seen, and talk about no exception in this case.
Right, the music is hugely important for a lot of reasons, one of which is that it propels the story. And when we got this great script from Michaela, who won our competition 2 years ago, we had a script competition. And one of the things that was so lovely about the script is that you had all these very, very different characters. And at that point, when we started looking at the script and talking through, well, what do we want to accomplish? One of the things that we felt immediately was important that every character had their own musical language. They embody a certain musical world. By using these three different composers who all studied composition at UNCSA, what we've wound up with is this wonderfully varied musical language where we do have something that's more pop-oriented, and then we have something that's more swing, Andrew Sisters style. We have a tango. We have all sorts of wonderful musical languages happening as well.
Yeah, sort of like leitmotifs on steroids.
Absolutely.
Every character, not only do you get a different theme, but a different musical style and a different composer.
And that's what we were, that's what we were going for, and it's turned out wonderfully.
It's tiring, always chasing after the next thing.
William, I had no idea, in addition to music and all these instruments you play, you're an actor as well.
I suppose so, yes.
Well, as a musician who was always afraid of forgetting lines, I was terrified of forgetting lines so much that I never did any theater. But what kind of crossover, just from music to acting?
There's certainly a lot of crossover, just the sort of comfort of being up on stage. It's also a very different monster.
How so? You're my guinea pig. You're up there. You're a musician who's done stuff on stage.
Of course, I'm still kind of figuring out exactly how it's different and where the crossover is really helpful and where it's sort of not.
Mm. Memorizing music, memorizing lines, it's a completely different beast.
The lines that come easier to me are the ones that are sung. The dialogue is a lot more challenging for me. Potentially because it's so naked. It's so just, that's it.
Yeah.
Those words, my actions, that's all that conveys it. I can't, you know, can't go G major, you know. There's none of that helping me out. There's none of that backing me up. So,
who are you in the play?
I am Gordy's older brother, Alexander.
Alexander.
Big man on campus. Everybody in school loves Alexander. He's in the 8th grade and he's super popular and all the things I kind of wasn't in eighth grade. So,
what? I can't believe that.
And he gets to sing an awesome rock style ballad opening for the show.
What did you do this summer? Well, the stories are long. It's tooting my own trumpet, but it's better in song. Can someone back me up here? 'Cause it's gonna take a village to deliver.
But from a directorial standpoint, then, are there certain standards that you acquired at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art and King's College in London during your studies there versus here in the States, things you took away from that where, no, it's got to work this way? See, I'm going to give all your bag of tricks right now in 5 minutes.
Okay.
Do we need to close our ears?
No, because I already said it to you guys. With music, it's very apparent, right? If someone hits a sour note. With drama, where your body is your instrument, it's words, it's emotions. When it hits the right note, everybody responds to it instinctively. Any age, any human gets it. The difficulty is that with drama, it's possible to make the right gesture towards it and it doesn't quite hit. And the audience will assume, oh, I just don't get it.
Hmm.
And it's not the audience, it's the performer who hasn't hit the note.
And that's a very uncomfortable feeling in the audience, by the way.
Yeah.
You get a feeling like, I know that should have been meaningful, but somehow it wasn't for me, and now I feel bad for them and for me.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. Yes. Or the classic is, I guess I just don't like Shakespeare. I don't get it.
Yeah.
Well, that's actually a comment on something different that's happening, that the performance didn't quite gel. The actor didn't quite know how to communicate it.
He's always winning prizes.
My thanks to Open Dream Ensemble actor Haiti Thompson, playwright and actor Michaela Morton, general manager Rebecca Nussbaum, actor-musician William von Reichbauer, and we began with Big Shoes director Beth Bostick. The Open Dream Ensemble premiere of this original musical is this Saturday, September 1st at 2 o'clock in Thrust Theater on the University of North Carolina School of the Arts campus. The family-friendly performance is free and open to the public thanks to the Thomas S. Kanin Institute for the Arts. This is Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford. Next, it's time for Pictures at an Exhibition on the campus of Wake Forest University. The Charlotte and Philip Haynes Arts Gallery at Wake Forest has a new exhibition going on. The opening reception was yesterday afternoon, and the arts community is all abuzz about Of Paper, which will remain on display through October 7th. The Fine Arts Gallery engages and challenges viewers through a series of 6 to 8 exhibits of mostly contemporary art each year. New gallery director Paul Bright hopes to engage gallery goers and provide them with a direct experience with the artwork. Paul is an accomplished artist himself who's worked for years in museums, galleries, and as a freelance designer. After assistant directing the Haynes Gallery for 8 years, Paul's given plenty of thought to maximizing the wonderful viewing space in the Scales Fine Arts Center, and the Of Paper exhibition is a strong step in that direction. Artist and Winston-Salem State University professor Leo Morrissey's data mining exhibit is made up of incised and excavated books, watercolors, mail art, and other paper-related works. And Italian artist Delio Genai's Laboratory of Signs exhibit transforms architectural and decorative elements from the architecture in his native Pisa into dimensional paper structures. I was wondering if you are ever up against this natural attraction to art that pleases you and having to then, in your other part of the brain, think, what would the average viewer appreciate or need apart from my likes and wants?
Yeah, I think that's a really valid point. You don't want your taste to be the only determining factor in the exhibitions you come up with. And what's interesting to me is even the exhibitions I've curated so far at the gallery, a lot of them started out with art that somehow obviously interested me, but I wasn't completely sold on or understood to the extent that I needed to really display it in a gallery situation. So there was a learning curve for me. It's like there was that seed of interest for whatever reason, but then spending time with it, doing some research, and usually for me, writing about it really helps clarify my ideas and thoughts, and then I start to see why it caught me in the first place.
Hmm.
So it isn't necessarily that, you know, I show things that I like. It's like I learn to experience them in a way. I learn to appreciate them and understand them through the process.
Could you think of an example where something perked your interest, a piece of art, a process, and then by writing about it, you've uncovered
hey, maybe that's why that really moved me.
Well, even with the two artists we're showing initially this year, Dalia Janai from Italy and Leo Morrissey from here in Winston-Salem, I was just a little bit familiar with Leo's work, not greatly familiar. I knew Leo much better than his work. Mm-hmm. And just started talking about it a little bit. And he had a small show downtown a few years ago, and I saw the pieces. And again, not fully understanding them, but they were interesting objects. And I thought, well, you know, something could be done with that. And as I dug further into this project and looked at more of his work and started putting my thoughts down, it kind of blossomed. It's not just these book objects that he does, but there's this whole sort of layers of cycles of work that he's constantly putting out, and they all relate to one another. And that to me was kind of the big revelation, that this whole thing formed this sort of orbit around a nucleus. Mm. And that was what held it all together in the end, I think.
Yeah, I'm always so, I have to say it, I'm jealous of just smart writers. And the two that I'm coming across here locally are you and Stephen Matisio, another person who just
Stephen's
writes extremely
writer.
Well yeah. About...
Very articulate.
Very yeah. articulate. And I'm coming across the line that summarized that too. Morrissey's open-ended body of work encompasses a series of overlapping projects of varying frequencies that, like the orbits of electrons around a nucleus, to a large extent define the substance of the artist's life. And I just love that. In one sentence, you kind of... There's a searching quality to so much of what he does that yeah. I find just fascinating.
And Dalio's exhibition's titled Laboratory of Signs, and so there's this sort of connection on that level, too. It's not just the material they're working with, but how they approach it on some level is also very similar. They do a sort of research in their work. And Dalio comes from a true research background. He worked in a genetics laboratory in Pisa, so... He became familiar with the tools, the processes, the methodology, and some of that gets transferred to how he works with paper. And with Leo, it's a different set of investigations, sort of how is a person placed in the contemporary world and the things around them and how that influences what you do and how you think about it.
That's Wake Forest University Art Gallery Director Paul Bright. He's just curated a new exhibition titled Of Paper, which will remain on display through October 7th. We'll take a short break now, and when we get back, Paul talks about Italian artist Dalio Janai and his Laboratory of Signs exhibit. And I'll be speaking with exhibiting artist Leo Morrissey about data mining and what's in it for him. I'm David Ford, and this is Triad Arts Up Close. Welcome back to Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford. The Charlotte and Philip Haynes Arts Gallery at Wake Forest University has new leadership and a new exhibition going on. Director Paul Bright stopped by to talk about his vision for the gallery, the new exhibition called Of Paper, and the artists whose work he's curating. Winston-Salem State professor, artist Leo Morrissey, and Italian artist Dalio Janai. Dalio established the Studio Janai in Pisa back in 1987 and has since hosted nearly 300 exhibitions. His exhibit at the Wake Gallery is titled Laboratory of Signs. Dalio Janai's work, just the intricacy of it, the detail, the perfect symmetry, these geometric figures beautifully outlaid in paper, sculpture, and drawing, for me indicated a foundation of almost knowingness, which would seem to contradict the searching that I see of all these profiles cut out of books of Leo.
Yeah, the end result, you know, the forms in each case are very different. And for Dalio, the research is maybe less visible so that, you know, the end result we see, but the investigations he does for the patterns that he ends up using, that sort of thing, a lot of them are derived from medieval architecture in Pisa and contain both Christian motifs and symbology, as well as a lot of from the Islamic world at the time, because there was a great deal of both contention and confrontation, but also kind of collusion. It was a very fluid time historically, and it shows up in the history of these cities and the architecture and the images. And he makes great use of that in his work. That's what he's kind of transliterating for us.
So you don't see the behind-the-scenes effort and labor that go into that tangentially? Just, I guess it's a watercolor piece of Leo's, I don't know if it's in this exhibit, Yiddish posted up there.
Yeah, all sorts of different things. And, of course, when Leo finds these books, I'm not quite sure how he decides which pages to reveal. In some cases, it's clearer than others. But there's always a little bit of a twist to it. Like, when I wrote the essay about his work, it's about him sort of positing himself in these spaces or places psychologically, imagining it physically. So he's, like, trying out different iterations of self in these contexts.
I'm more conceptually based than I am materials based. You know, I mean, some people are painters. You know, they paint. They know every day they're going to wake up and paint. I mean, I do certain things every day. I've been, you know, but it doesn't mean that that won't change or I won't use other materials. You know, when you see the show, when you see my work, you come through my studio filled with paper.
For listeners, envision a book and envision a very recognizable profile, in this case, Leo Morrissey, and that profile has been carved into the book in a concavity.
Mm-hmm.
So the image of, you know, immediately who we're dealing with, but you're embedded in this book through layers of paper. You're saying if the medium would have been easier on a candle, we would be seeing Leo carved into wax. How did you get there?
I came to this process from one day, and I've been doing these. I mean, I think the earliest works in the show go back to like the late 90s maybe.
I think
I've been doing this for a long time. I had made artist books before, but I came to cutting books in this fashion through the realization one morning working in my studio that the little paintings I was doing with added text were starting to look like book covers. And maybe I needed to look at books. So I went out and bought a couple of books with no idea what I was going to do with them. Then I came up with an idea. I mean, and basically what the process is, I mean, I buy books that are basically information-based books. Conceptually, I believe information-based books are created to give us information that we can use however we so desire, rightly or wrongly or whatever. I don't cut up other people's creative work, fiction, poetry, but I don't go there. Once I buy a book based on something catches me about the visual cover, title, just the aesthetics of the cover, something like that. All my books primarily come from library discards, thrift shops, yard sales, stuff that's on the way out. The profile is put on the cover. The selection of where the profile gets cut is an aesthetic decision. So I cut the profile. Once I cut the profile, then I start reading through the book anything that might show through that what I call portal, you know, that little window. As I find things I think are interesting, I put little post-it notes in that page, make a little note. And in the exhibition, you'll see everything from small little paperbacks to entire sets of encyclopedias and 2- and 3-volume dictionaries and things. You know, I can tag 10, 12 little pieces. I can tag a couple hundred. And then once I do that, I then start to weed through them and try to see, put together a visual, verbal narrative, come up with some kind of thing I want to say. And then I have to see what lines up. I edit things in and out. I start to get practical. Then I make templates and go back through pages because I don't move anything in a book. Like something – two things I'm interested in overlap in a book and I can't make them align the way I would need to. I have to edit one of them out. It's not like – I mean it would be very easy to take an X-Acto knife and a glue stick and cut one and shift the word, but I don't do that. And make these templates, lay things over, boom, boom, boom. Just keep working it until I come up with the final narrative or the visual presentation I want. And then I have to sit down there and figure out a way of cutting through because they're all cut by hand, that a way I can cut it and reveal these different layers and see if that it will practically work. Once I determine that, then it's a done deal. The book just starts to be cut by hand.
Can I read the text top to bottom?
Everything that I've exposed. Whatever I want you to see, you can read. Anything I don't want you to see, I've cut in a way that it's eliminated. Everything that you can see in a book has been intentionally left because I want you to see that.
Are they complete sentences? Is it fragmented prose?
Mostly it's fragments, words, little images, graphs, depending on the books. Sometimes it can be simply a dot on a map. You know, it's everyone is different. Everyone's unique. There's obviously a certain conceptual thread through a lot of the works. And when I do, sometimes I'll get into a groove where I'll be working with a certain type of book. You know, I might do a series of books that, you know, and I'm like, whatever's going on in my head's, you know, driving me to deal with, say, sociopolitical issues. But then other times I might be just playing with word games and cutting up dictionaries and, you know, focusing on words or places. And usually the book takes me there.
That's artist Leo Morrissey. His exhibit, Data Mining, is part of a dual exhibition going on at the Charlotte and Philip Haynes Art Gallery at Wake Forest University titled Of Paper. His work is joined by Italian artist Delio Genai's exhibit Laboratory of Signs. My thanks to director Paul Bright, who has curated the exhibition, his first since taking over the reins as the new gallery director. Of Paper will remain on display through October 7th. It's in the Scales Fine Arts Center on the Wake Forest University campus, and you'll find links on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. This is Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford, and it's time for another short intermission. In just about 60 seconds, we're back in a dynamic new way. Our good friend Mr. Peter Karoff is here to explore everything from pianissimo to fortissimo and beyond next, when Triad Arts Up Close continues.
Welcome back to Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford, and this is our good friend Peter Karoff in a little music theory that makes a huge difference in our understanding classical music.
Hi there. Today I'd like to talk with you about a word that we use in the musical world to describe the louds and softs of music, and that word is dynamics. It's quite obvious that the loudness with which you play a particular passage would deeply affect its meaning and impact. Just imagine, I don't know, the beginning of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, that dramatic opening, and just imagine if it were... It has a completely different impact. And so dynamics are very, very important in how we perceive music, how we feel the expressive power of music. Likewise, imagine a delicate piece like Debussy's Clair de Lune. And you know what I'm going to do. Imagine it extra loud. Yikes. It has a completely different effect. So like saying a word to a friend loud or saying that same word soft, it has a different meaning, a different emotional content. Likewise, the dynamics with which a composer asks us to perform the music completely change the way we experience it. But you see, there's more to dynamics than simply how loud or how soft. Most of the music we hear, after all, is not just one note at a time, but layers of sounds. And so quite often, a composer will have multiple layers of dynamics at the same time. Here's a piece by Robert Schumann from about, 1830. A beautiful piano piece called simply Romance. Now, the melody is actually not at the top of this composition. It's kind of buried in the middle down here. And the accompaniment is both above it and below it. And so here again, here's the piece, the melody in the middle and the accompaniment surrounding it. Now, let's just pretend that there were no dynamic differences there, and if all the notes were exactly the same volume, it would be actually completely incoherent. Listen to it once. This is the same exact piece, but all the dynamics taken out of it. Yuck. So you can see that with music that has lots going on, harmony, melody, dynamics serve not simply to make it this part's loud and this part soft, but also to highlight certain aspects of the musical texture. In this case, the melody in the middle, more prominent. So we can think of dynamics almost like shading in painting. You know, if you look at a painting and some areas of the painting are more bright and they seem to be more prominent or more in the foreground, and areas more darkly shaded recede into the background. And that's exactly what happens in musical dynamics. Here's another example. This is a piece by Rachmaninoff from the early 20th century, and all kinds of dynamics going on in here. First of all, very much like in the Schumann piece, the melody is down below, and so if you're not careful, the accompaniment would actually hide the melody, except thanks to dynamics, we can hear the melody more prominently. Without dynamics, you would just hear the... So we have dynamics then for the shading, for the more prominent melody, but also within each level, within each dynamic level, let's say, you have lots of ebb and flow of dynamics. You have what we call, simply phrasing or expression, so that the melody isn't just a series of notes, but rather a kind of expressive, very personal, very warm, sighing, pleading melody, again, thanks to the dynamic inflections. So you see, this term dynamics, I can also just simply say the louds and softs within music, are very, very important from the composer's perspective, which material, which ideas, which motives, which melodies he wants or she wants more prominently heard, but also from the performer's side, how do we make it expressive? How do we make it live? How do we make it seem as if it's speaking to us through sound? Musical dynamics.
Pianist and Wake Forest University professor of music Peter Karoff at the keyboard. That's a little old segment we like to call Understanding Classical Music. And you heard it here on Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford. We've got the King Bees coming up later in the second half of the show. They've been stinging and swinging at the New River Blues Festival for 10 straight years, and they're here to play for us live in Studio A. But first, wouldn't you like to just curl up with a good book? My next guest sure hopes so. Bookmarks Book Festival celebrates good writing with the best of the best. This year, they're bringing New York Times best-selling authors, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporters, Grammy Award-winning musicians, and storytellers to the Triad for one glorious day dedicated to the art of the written word. On Saturday, September 8th, from 10:15 a.m. to 5 p.m., you're invited to enjoy the entire day from cover to cover with more than 40 authors and events spread out across 9 different venues in Winston-Salem's historic arts district. There'll be food for thought with Andrea Chessman, author of Recipes from the Root Cellar. Confederates in the Attic author Tony Horwitz will speak on the main stage. Author Esmeralda Santiago will lead a program in Spanish and English. There'll be outdoor author explorations, much, much more, and it's free. My guest today is Bookmarks Executive Director Ginger Hendricks. Well, I love the layout of the Festival of Books, Bookmarks Festival. The brochure layout is wonderful. I kind of want to follow that as our sure. our little trail guide. And conveniently enough, Young Readers Central is first on the list, the downtown school, 601 North Cherry Street. And Kelly Starling Lyons kicking things off September 8th at 10:15 a.m. and Stories of Discovery for young people.
Yeah, we're really excited about Kelly. One of the things that we do with our Young Readers Central, and we detail this in our brochure, is try to let parents know the age groups. And Kelly's a wonderful person to start the day. It's ages 5 through 8. It's an event that's presented with support from Piedmont Parent. Kelly's written a book called Ellen's Broom, which is about a old African-American tradition of jumping the broom after a wedding. And it's really beautifully illustrated. I think she's really going to appeal to a lot of children.
Consistently, you all have excellent authors and speakers and storytellers. And speaking to that, Alan Grant's coming up later that afternoon, and an ALA Top 10 Best Books Award for young adults. He'll be speaking that age range, a little bit older, 8 to 12-year-olds.
Well, Alan is great because we really want to reach out to our young male and little boy readers. Now, not that women and little girls aren't interested in baseball, but one of the challenges, and I'm sure I'll have that someday with my son, is making sure that little boys are interested. They're wanting to get out and run around. And Alan Gratz is wonderful because he's actually written about baseball, including Samurai, Shortstop, Something Wicked, and most recently, Fantasy Baseball, which has all types of literary characters interact with the baseball players.
That's one section of what's going to be an incredibly full day. Food for Thought is another. What was the thought behind Food for Thought?
Well, Food for Thought showcases our chefs and our cookbook authors. So we're really lucky we have GTCC, their culinary students, come out and actually prepare various recipes from these chefs' cookbooks. And as the chefs are speaking, our attendees get to actually try the different types of food that they're speaking about. And we've actually expanded our Food for Thought area this year because we've had such a great reception with it. And Andrea Chessman is one of the four authors that's coming. And right now, you know, we're seeing, and so many of us are participating in the various farmers markets. And Andrea is someone who can help you figure out how to use the produce that you are buying at these farmers markets. So I think she's going to be a real delight to listen to. She's written books called The Pickle Pantry, Recipes from the Root Cellar. Through her books, she can help you think about how you can take those summer vegetables and be able to enjoy them this fall.
Wow. And she's a real authority. I mean, her recipes and writings have appeared in Food and Wine and the New York Times, just to name a couple.
Absolutely.
main stage is going to be on 6th Street this time around, and several authors speaking. Tell me about John McCutcheon's work.
He's been nominated for the Grammys 7 times. He is a master of more than a dozen traditional instruments, including the rare hammer dulcimer. And he is not only a singer, but also, and really a folk singer, he's also a storyteller. So we're really excited about him. We're working with UNCG Libraries to bring him in. And he'll actually do 2 programs, one around lunchtime for folks to grab a bite to eat at one of the wonderful restaurants or down in the downtown area and be able to sit and listen to him. And then he also is going to do something near the end of the day. So when we're starting to wind down, folks are wanting to get their last books signed and picking up their last purchases and going to the last folks, John will be again singing and telling his story. So we think he's going to be an absolute delight.
Well, in terms of storytelling and more, I understand you're collaborating this year with the Hispanic League.
We have been longtime partners of the Hispanic League ever since we started our festival, and they are just a wonderful organization, and they always help us support bringing in one or two authors where we can have events either in Spanish and English, or for the first time this year, we're doing an event just in Spanish. We have Esmeralda Santiago coming, who is amazing award-winning author. She's written a new book. It's her first book out in quite a while, called Conquistadora, and it's an epic novel about love, discovery, and adventure. And her program will be in Spanish and English. We're also doing a story time in Spanish and English for children, so we're really feeling like that's something we just added last year, and we really like that. And the children who are able to hear a story in Spanish and then translated into English or vice versa. And it's really great for the students. And then finally, we also have an author, Carlos Alberto Montaner, who's actually an exiled Cuban author and journalist. He has a new book in Spanish, and he's also a political analyst for CNN in Spanish. And for the first time ever, we're going to do an event totally in Spanish. So we're really excited about that. And so is the Hispanic League.
Great. I should point out that we're highlighting authors and speakers and clinicians on each segment of the festival, but there are several more in each category, and you'll need to go to the website bookmarksnc.org to find the complete listing, and you want to take advantage of many of them because there's so many. How many different events are there?
We'll see. We're going to have 45 authors, and I believe there's 46 programs. So it's really wonderful, and it's all free, and we want folks to know that. We really want them to come out and spend the whole day with us, enjoy it from cover to cover.
Why not? My thanks to Bookmarks Executive Director Ginger Hendricks. The Bookmarks Book Festival is Saturday, September 8th from 10:15 a.m. to 5 p.m. You'll find links to the complete schedule on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. This is Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford, and we've got blues on the way with King Bees live in Studio A. They're just about 8 minutes away, and before we get to the blues, it's time for a trip to the barrio and 8 Latino artists, stunning abstracts, digital prints on canvas, gorgeous landscapes, seascapes, and more. They're all on display at Delta Arts Center in Winston-Salem. This remarkable exhibit, Puzzle Master Artists Friends, has been extended through mid-September at Delta, and you'll find links to images and more information on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. Artist Ronaldo Vargas wants to fill the emptiness of another's heart. Ale Fuentes wants to transmit the abstract spirit within. And Delta Arts Center's Rodney Holman is here to explain this Puzzle Master Artists Friends exhibition. The styles that are presented through this art, I'm just glimpsing through a few online, is really remarkable in how varied it is. I was looking at some Ronaldo Vargas work and just seeing the color jump off the page, the images of, I'm assuming, Cuba, and almost a collage technique with images juxtaposed upon one another. Really neat stuff going on there.
Sure, very colorful. And what I love about the exhibit is that mixture of styles. We have Gabriel Orenstein, who is a painter, but he also has a video installation as part of the exhibit. And now that's really hard to describe. It's something you have to see for yourself, but it's animated images. Mm-hmm. And Raul Montero, who mentions that he doesn't like to categorize his style, but he does say that he is switching from more naturalistic style to abstracts. But one of his older paintings, which is there, is called Christ of the Potato. And it's a man with a sack of potatoes on his back, the kind of painting that makes you want to interview the artist and find out, okay, what all were you thinking when you put this together?
There is a mystical element to a lot of the art that I'm seeing there, and that's something that they all subscribe to. Mm-hmm. Violeta Roque de Arana was talking about that whole awareness she has of geometry in an almost sacred sense. How does that weave its way into her art?
A lot of the pieces that she has in the show, a lot of people think, is that a painting or are these paintings on floor tiles? So she's got this very geometric presentation going on. And then she's got floral patterns painted. Same thing with, I guess, composer Philip Glass. You listen to his music and you hear that percussion and you're thinking, this is the physics of sound, the physics of percussion. So it's a similar thing. It's almost, you know, apparently some people are synesthetic. They hear a sound and see a color. I'm not like that, but when people have art of the sort that, you know, that fits her description, it's the closest that a non-synesthete can come to that experience.
Synesthete. You don't get to hear that word very much, sir. Only here on Try It After Close.
That's love right.
The eight of these artists coming from primarily Miami area now, Latino Americans.
Yeah.
Do you get a sense of that city, interacting with them over these weeks?
Well, they're all seven Cubans, one Uruguayan, seven of them living in Miami. And I did go up and talk to them as best as I could. I was a Spanish major. So when you are interacting with people from another country, another culture, another city, you do get instantly that different flavor that they bring. And it's usually, for me, it's a refreshing thing.
What sort of reaction have you been getting from the public?
Let's see. I think people really like the fact that there are that many artists represented because they get to walk around and see eight different styles all at once. And that's what I like best about it, too. I think people also enjoyed at the opening, they could speak to the artist and ask them some questions. And I think they also like the opportunity that some of the press that we've gotten gives them a chance to read up about the exhibit before they come and after they've had a chance to take a look at it.
So another, I mean, concurrently going on right now is this Cool Clear Water project. Tell me about that project.
Sure.
For starters.
PowerToGive.org is a new opportunity brought to Winston-Salem by the Arts Council. Arts Council funded partners, and there are 88 of them, can post a project for 3 months at a time, and the local community, people can go online for $5 or more, make a donation to bring that project to life. Delta Arts Center has two broken water fountains, and our project through early September is to raise $1,100 to replace those two water fountains. And we are hoping that people go to powertogive.org and make a donation.
My thanks to Delta Arts Center's Rodney Holman. This remarkable exhibit, Puzzle Master Artists Friends, has been extended through mid-September, and you'll find links to more information on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. You'll also find information on how you can bring cool, clear water to Delta. You can make this very useful project a big success. The Arts Council of Winston-Salem and Forsyth County makes it easy, and you'll find links on our website. Again, it's wfdd.org/triadarts. I'm David Ford. Got any weekend plans yet? Well, how does dancing in a mountain meadow by a sparkling river to world-class blues sound? The 10th Annual New River Blues Festival 2012 is making your blues fantasy a reality this Sunday, September 2nd, at the River House Inn in beautiful Grassy Creek, North Carolina, on the shores of the New River. Gates open at noon, the music starts at 1, and it'll be performed live by world-renowned, Grammy-nominated Piedmont blues giant John D. Holman, Blues Hall of Famer Chick Willis, Mac Arnold, Sandra Hall, and more, including my next guests, New River Blues Festival directors Penny Queen Bee Zamagni and Rob Hound Dog Baskerville. Together they form the King Bees, and they've been stinging and swinging for 25 years with the likes of Bo Diddley, Carrie Bell, B.B. King, Nappy Brown, and many others. We've been sampling from last year's King Bees release titled Carolina Bound, and next we get to hear them live. It's the King Bees.
That was the King Bees.
Now, not only did the King Bees, we're talking about Penny, Queen Bees of Magny, and Rob Hound Dog Baskerville, making the trek in 2 hours on the road to come on Try It Arts Up Close. You brought your band and all the equipment with you. We got to listen to some music.
got to stop. Oh, it's just a stone's throw from here, the studio.
Yeah, you know? Let's just pop
let's
right
do
and
it.
Pop over
I'm
there.
Excited
what,
about it.
What are we going to kick things off with here?
Let's do Sugar Papa.
Sugar Papa. It's a swing tune. It's somewhat traditional, but I've mixed in some other lyrics and made up a few of my own. And we've got a jumping little arrangement.
All right. Well, let's jump on in then with Sugar Papa. We've got Martin Henderson on drums.
Yep.
And Rob's going to be playing not only guitar, but a little organ for us on this one as well. As
yeah. I recall.
And Queen Bee's going to be on the bass and vocals. This is Sugar Papa, the King Bees, here live in Studio A.
Sugar Papa, Sugar Papa, what makes your sugar? Sugar Papa, where do you get that good sugar from? Hey, yeah! Sugar Papa, where do you get that good sugar from? He was raised in Louisiana, way down on your mama's sugar farm. Well, they're bragging about your sugar. They're bragging all the time.
Thank you.
Studio A.
Did we call it Studio A? Yeah. We'd like to call it Studio B, but we've only got the one studio. So it's studio. Well, that's an awesome tune. I mean, I call that a showpiece for a vocalist. I mean, holy smokes. The growls, the nuance, the licks. I mean, are you a natural at this? Is this something that you just dived in and, I can rip this stuff off?
It was tough at first, the bass playing and the singing, putting those together. But finally, it all went, whoa, okay.
Does it click like that after years? Or
it took about a good year of feeling that I was never going to do it right. And then after that year, things fell into place for some reason.
Because I got to say, you're not just not a lot of pedal tones when you're singing. You're walking that bad boy and singing at the same time. That's just some great playing.
Always working on it. Always a project in progress.
Yeah. And then you're shifting from instrument to instrument now, Rob. What's the transition like going from the guitar solo right into the organ right away? And then is your approach to improvising on the organ any different than on your acts?
Yes, it's much more limited.
Well, okay. You convinced me.
Yeah. You know, my grandmother was a piano and an organ teacher, so that was my first instrument. And it's been a long, long time since I took lessons from it. But, you know, I listened to a lot of organ players over the years, and my dad would, of course, take me to see the Basie Band. And so all of my ideas come from just a couple of places and the dynamics that, say, a big band like that use are always behind. When you have limited licks, you use a lot of creativity in other ways in arrangements and that kind of thing.
Yeah, interesting you mentioned Count Basie, the master of the minimalist approach to improv.
Yeah.
Just a few notes say so much.
That's the idea.
Yeah. No, it sounded great. And you reminded me of the great thing about blues. I mean, the humor.
Thank you. Finally, someone says that, because you see all these blues bands in their promo picture. They're all going to have sunglasses and have their arms crossed and scowling. What are you scowling about? I mean, this music is great. It's fun.
Talking about humor, this next tune, I mean, I just love the name of this one. Everyone loves Ham Hock Stew. I know this is a bitter love song.
Let's get down to it. The real blues folks don't drink Chardonnay or eat filet mignon. They eat Boston Button. They eat Ham Hock Stew or whatever.
Right. We've seen this.
We've been around it.
Well, how did this tune come about, though, besides the reality, the earthiness of the stew? I hope it's not a true life story.
I love Penny's intro. She often does live, which sort of explains a bit of what you're asking.
The song may not be a true story, but I will say that I did write it, and that my husband can't cook a lick. So imagine how you would feel after a hard day of work when you walk in the door and the house smells like home cooking. And you know he doesn't cook. So what is your first emotion?
I'm not lying this time, baby.
Suspicion. You're suspicious. So that's what this song is about.
All right. Well, my appetite and my musical appetite has been whetted with that one. Let's sashay on over. We're in Studio A with the King Bees, and this is Penny Queen Bees de Magny and Rob Hound Dog Baskerville, along with drummer Martin Henderson. The King Bees, live in Studio A with Penny's tune, Ham Hock Stew. Thank you.
got to throw away the bond.
My thanks to Penny Queen Biza Magni and Rob Hound Dog Baskerville, the co-directors of the New River Blues Festival. This year marks the 10th anniversary of bringing the luminaries and lifeblood of blues to the heart of rural Appalachia. New River Blues 2012 is this Sunday, September 2nd, at the River House Inn in beautiful Grassy Creek, North Carolina, on the shores of the New River. Gates open at noon with live music from 1 to 6, performed by world-renowned, Grammy-nominated Piedmont blues giant John D. Holman, Blues Hall of Famer Chick Willis, Mac Arnold, Sandra Hall, the King Bees, and more. 5 full hours of hot blues in the cool mountains. Advance tickets are $15, 18 at the door, and you'll find links to more information on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts.
Chinese food if you don't want to fuss and fight about that gal. She came around when I was gone. She fixed your ham hock stew, but you forgot to throw away the bone.
Well, that's all for today's program. Our senior producer is Catherine Mobley, and our audio engineer is Eddie Garcia. You'll find links to more information about all of the arts organizations and events we've covered today on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. And as always, I'd love to hear from you. Please send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for joining me today for Triad Arts Up Close.